Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 6:40 p.m. on Thursday, April 7th, 2016. Present, we have Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Thompson. We have Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgman, Representative Munoz, and there'll be others joining us shortly. Before we start, make sure your cell phones are off. No electronic devices allowed in committee. On today's schedule, we have House Bill 365, Income Tax Permanent Fund Tax Credits. And under bills previously heard or scheduled, we will be introduced to the committee substitute for SB 74, Medicaid Reform Telemedicine Drug Database. First, we're going to bring back Senate Bill 74, Medicaid Reform Telemedicine and Drug Database. We have a House CS for CSSB 74 version 2. Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we bring House CS for SB 74 Finance, version 29LS0692/T for Tango, before House Finance for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Okay. My staff, Jane Pearson, would you please place yourself on the record and explain the differences between House Bill CS for SB 74 Finance Version T and the CS for SB 74 Finance Version UA. And we're just going to introduce it tonight. We're not going to get into questions and breakdowns, so it'll be an interesting introduction. Ms. Pearson.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. There are title changes in the bill to conform with the changes in the bill. Section 1, pages 2 through 3, lines 19 through 8, adds telehealth for registered audiologist assistants, and that's an AS 11080. Section 2, pages 3, lines 13 through 28, adds telehealth for licensed speech-language pathologist assistants. Section 3 adds telehealth for licensed speech-language pathologists. Section 5 requires a licensed dentist with a federal DEA registration number to register with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Database. Section 7 requires that a physician with a federal DEA number registered with the Controlled Substance Database. Section 10 requires that an advanced nurse practitioner with a federal DEA number register with the Controlled Substance Database. Section 11 on page 9, lines 11 through 16, requires that an optometrist with a federal DEA number registered with the Controlled Substance Database. Section 12 requires a licensed pharmacist with a federal DEA number to register with the Controlled Substance Database. Section 13 on pages 10, on page 10, lines 19 through 21. Excuse me, I just read that. That's the pharmacist. Section 13 adds telehealth protections for licensed physical therapists and occupational therapists. Section 18 is conforming language for the removal of seizure and forfeiture of property. Page 13, lines 20 through 24, allows full and reasonable attorney's fees and costs in a fraudulent claim. Page 13, lines 28 through 29, allows for Rule 82 attorney's fees and costs for a case that does not involve fraud. Page 14, line 7, limits liability to this section rather than the full chapter. Page 14, lines 11 through 12, adds protection to the principal in a fraud case if their agent acted with intent to deceive the principal. Page 17 and 18, lines 30, ending on line 3, allows for full and reasonable attorney's fees and costs in a fraudulent claim and allows for Rule 82 attorney's fees for cases that do not involve fraud. Page 19, lines 16, 22, and 24 are conforming amendments. Section 21, page 22, lines 1 through 4, removes references to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. This shows up later in the bill. Section 22, page 22 through 23, lines 31 through 2, adds that if a person picking up a prescription is not the person to whom the drug was prescribed, the pharmacist shall collect their name and date of birth. Section 23, starting on page 23, lines 17 through 21, adds that an agent of a practitioner who has access to the prescription drug monitoring database must be licensed or registered under AS08. Page 23, lines 23 through 27, adds that an agent of a pharmacist that has access to the prescription drug monitoring database must be licensed or registered under AS08. Page 23, line 30, removes the word subpoena so that a search warrant or a court order must be obtained by law enforcement to access the prescription drug monitoring database. Page 24, lines 26 through 27, allows a practitioner employed by the United States Indian Health Services to access the database if they are registered. Section 26, page 25, lines 21 and 24, removes pharmacists from having to check the prescription drug monitoring database before dispensing. Page 25, lines 21 through 25, states that the practitioner only, not the pharmacist, has to review the database before prescribing or dispensing Schedule 2 or 3 controlled substances, removing Schedule 4. Page 26, lines 4 through 7, adds two exceptions for reviewing the database before dispensing. The first is 48 hours immediately before, during, or after surgery or medical procedure. Number two is in a hospice or nursing home that has an in-house pharmacy. Number three, a non-refillable prescription of a controlled substance in a quantity intended to last no more than 3 days. Section 27 sets forth the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development shall assist the pharmacist board and provide staff necessary and equipment to implement the prescription drug monitoring database. It shall establish fees for registration with the database with a pharmacist or practitioner for operational costs to be shared equally among all required to register, and consult with the board to establish fees. Section 28 on page 27, line 5, deletes monetary recoveries under the Alaska Medical Assistance False Claim Reporting Act. Page 27, lines 4 through 18, states that the Commissioner of DOC shall apply for medical assistance for prisoners during a period of hospitalization outside the correctional facilities, and allows DOC to obtain necessary information to determine whether a prisoner is eligible for medical assistance, and that the information obtained may only be used to apply for that assistance. Section 32, page 28, lines 16 through 17, adds security provisions to the computerized eligibility verification system. Section 36 on page 31, AS 4705-260 was deleted. It had to do with seizures and forfeitures. Page 15, lines 23 through 27, adds subsection 15 to the reporting requirements, the amount of state funds saved as a result of policy authorizing 100% federal funding provided for American Indian and Alaska Native individuals eligible for Medicaid, and estimated savings that the department had fully implemented the changes in the policy. Section 38. Request that the department give continuing cooperation to grant-funded community mental health clinics and drug and alcohol treatment centers that have historically provided such care to recipients. Section 39, on page 39, lines 5 through 6, amends the coordinated care project to include 9 innovative payment processes, including bundled payments or global payments. Page 40 and 41, amends the project review committee membership. Page 41, line 30, amends third-party actuary review of demonstration projects from 1 to 2 years. Section 40, reports. As an additional report to require the department to prepare semi-annually a report to the legislature on the Medicaid Management Information System. Section 43 amends 4725-140, which prohibits the ability to receive public assistance benefits while in institutions like nursing homes or correctional facilities. Section 46 is a repealer for Section 40 that says once the MMS system has been certified, the reports are repealed. Page 47 is conforming language regarding attorney fees changes. Section 50 is feasibility studies. It removes a section to study privatization of Alaska Pioneers Homes and selects facilities at the Division of Juvenile Justice. And this was a drafting error. It was just meant to be Alaska Pioneer Homes should be studied for their pharmacy, and Division of Juvenile Justice privatization studies should have stayed in there. Section 51, pages 48 through 49, lines 28 through 13, requires a report from medical professionals regarding recommended guidelines for prescribing Schedule II controlled substances. And the rest of the changes are just conforming changes.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. We're actually just going to do the rollout tonight. It's going to have some time for people to digest it because there's so much involved, and it is a late hour. So this is on a basis. It was put on, this CS was put on basis about 1 o'clock this afternoon, so it is available to everybody. And seeing no more, or seeing that that was the end of the presentation, I'm going to set House Bill CS for CSSB 74 Finance aside at this time. Now we will hear the introduction of House Bill 365, Income Tax Permanent Fund Tax Credits, by Representative Seaton. We have a sponsor CS for this bill, version P. Representative Newman, can you please make a motion?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I move committee substitute for House Bill 365 version 29 LS1422/P before the committee for discussion purposes and referral.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, we're addressing the CS. Here today to introduce us to the bill is Representative Paul Seaton and his staff, Jenny Martin. And please place yourselves on the record and begin your introduction and presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paul Seaton, House District 31, the lower half of the Kenai Peninsula. And I appreciate the opportunity to present this plan to you tonight. House Bill 365 combines several things. But first of all, we've all had the reminder from Gunnar Knapp recently that not paying for what we spend this year means that our children will pay for what we spend this year. And so keeping that in mind, here is kind of the plan that we've seen around. There's three parts of it. One is sensible spending cuts, new revenue, and then looking at the PFD and the permanent fund. And right now, the legislature is looking at controlling the sensible spending cuts, and that's totally within the control of the legislature. You have a number of bills before you, and so this plan isn't dealing with those directly. Most of the other plans that have been put forward are dealing with restructuring the permanent fund, and the money that they get is derived solely from either draining more money from the fund or by decreasing or eliminating the PFD. This plan, House Bill 365, combines new revenues and the PFD. And what it does is, by doing this, if you're reducing the PFD, it hits hardest on large families with many kids or low-income families. And so that's balanced in this plan with new revenue coming from an income tax because that hits harder, higher-income families. So in this way, we don't have any one segment of the population, rural or urban, that is paying more percentage-wise than the other. And here's the income tax segment of that, and you'll see that it's at 15% of the federal tax liability, which raises about $500 million. And it should be noted that from 1961 through 1975, when Alaska had a very similar income tax, that was at 16%. So this is actually lower than the rate which people paid earlier in Alaska. It also includes a 10% long-term capital gains, and that raises about $85 million. And this is an interesting idea that turns out that a whole lot of states have this. Ours here is a 10% capital gains rate. It turns out that California has a 13.3 capital gains rate. Oregon has a 9.9%, Idaho 7.4, et cetera. And if you look around at the states that are not having budget problems, most of them have found that the solution is also having a capital gains component. And then the other thing is it raises about $70 million from non-residents. About 20% of the workers, a little over 20% of workers in Alaska are non-residents to Alaska, and this makes sure that they're contributing based on the same proportion, same tax rate as residents. So if we look at the changes that we're making to the PFD, first of all, some of the beauty of this plan is that what it does, it leaves everybody doing the job that they know how to do. In other words, right now we have a PFD division and we have the Permanent Fund Corporation. The Permanent Fund Corporation manages the pot of money. The division works on PFDs. In this plan, they stay exactly the same. The difference is that instead of the 50% of the distributable earnings, that's the 21% of the five-year average of earnings that goes into the distributable earnings, instead of 50% of that going to pay dividends, 25% of it goes to pay dividends, and 25% of it goes to pay for services through the general fund. The other 50% still stays with the earnings reserve just like it does now. Another component of this plan is that if the dividend calculation would be over $1,200, the excess over $1,200 would go to the general fund, and also it would have the PFD could be, there'd be a checkbox when you make your application for the permanent fund dividend. You check the box, you want your PFD to be applied as a credit against your income taxes. So that was basically the plan, but most people wanted to see a more comprehensive plan that would be all together, and so what we've added there is a 2.3% POMV, or percent of market value, draw on the value of the permanent fund, and that would go to the general fund, and also, like the other plans, it eliminates inflation proofing. And the reason for eliminate inflation proofing is that over 80% of all the investments by the Permanent Fund Corporation have some kind of internal inflation proofing in them already. So up now you see this bubble chart, and this is the current system. So I'm just going to go through it so we're all on the same page. The first thing is that up here in the top, oil and gas, mineral royalties, you know, those are the real supplies of money. And currently 25 to 30% is going into the permanent fund royalties. The other 70 to 75% goes to the general fund. In the past, that's been as high by statute as high as 50%. But here's the permanent fund, and all the money that it makes flows to the earnings reserve. From the earnings reserve, a couple of things happen. First of all, to the left, there's an automatic inflation proofing that goes out. Or to the right scale there, you can see the legislature has two options. It can, by simple majority vote, appropriate earnings and put them either in the general fund, or it can appropriate earnings and put that in the principal, which we've done several times in the past. But the earnings reserve itself, 21% of the five-year average of the earnings goes to the distributable income account. So that's the way it works now, and then 50% of that goes to calculate the PFD. The PFD goes down, and you can do pick, click, give, and then the PFD goes to right out to the resident. So now, oops.
I'm sorry, I think they voted the wrong one.
Okay, well, we got the wrong one. Anyway, we had these sequentially in the other drawing, and it got loaded wrong. Anyway, let's look at the center here. This is the income tax, the $655 million that we saw, and that goes directly to the general fund. Okay, just above that, you can see here's the distributable income, and what we're doing is we're splitting that 25% of that goes down to calculate the PFD, and then 25%, an equal amount, goes over and deposits in the general fund. As you calculate the PFD, if it's over $1,200, the excess amount goes to the general fund, so there's a cap on the PFD. PFD calculation comes down, made just like it is now. Donations, pick, give, or college funds, just like it is now. And then it goes over to the other option, which is a refundable tax payment paid to the state income tax. Now, this is totally optional. A person can check the box, and in which case the money will be transferred into your account at the tax division, be applied against your tax from your income tax, and the rest will be sent to you with your income tax return. Or you can not check that box, and the money will go right through and be sent out to you just as a regular permanent fund dividend. So again, everybody is doing their complete job exactly as they are now. We don't have to restructure the permanent fund dividend, the fund itself, and we don't have to restructure the dividend. We change the percentage that comes out of the distributable earnings, and that's the only change that's made there. The POMV is a separate calculation that is made on the basis of the entire fund and the earnings combined and that value, and that then averages about $1.1 billion and goes, but there's no impact on the PFD. So this is not making the POMV to calculate a dividend. This is making the POMV to figure out how much is a draw that we can take to the general fund for spending without damaging at all the earnings reserve or the permanent fund dividend. So here are the numbers. The total estimated revenue is $655 million from the income tax. The distributable income, that's a split with the PFD, $686 million based on 2015 numbers. 2.3% POMV draw from the earnings reserve to the general fund is $1.1 billion. So we get a total amount of $2.44 billion. Now, $2.44 billion is not yet our total debt. We don't want to, or total deficit, we don't want to forget the other active work the legislature is doing in controlling the budget and budget cuts. But here's the way, if we take and look through one of the plans that is out there where you can run through a model. Let's first go through and look at the status quo, where we are now. Right now, the CBR will be exhausted in 2018. And if you look at the earnings reserve, this red line here, the earnings reserve is exhausted 2021. As you can see up here in the upper right, the permanent fund value itself is still growing a little, and then it declines. And you can see there are three large years of dividends, $2,000+, and then it would be $2,000 the next year, but there's no money to pay for it because we have lost the money in the CBR and the earnings reserve has declined. So in the final two, under status quo, there'll be 3 years of big dividends and then no dividends. So the blue bars here, right at $1,000 going on out, is the permanent fund dividend under this plan. So, as you can see, the CBR is the only thing that's really going down here, and that still would go out to about 2024 in this model, and that's with no budget cuts. That's none of the budget cuts that we're talking about. So this plan keeps the earnings reserve there, in fact, growing a little. The permanent fund itself grows of $5 billion over the next 5 years, about 2% a year. And so that's where that is. And so just for an example of what can it do if we do some budget cuts, we'll go to the next slide. And here is looking at about $450 million worth of budget cuts, whether that is in this example I took, and I use the oil tax or the motor fuels tax that you have before you, $49 million, the 1% increase to $18 million in fish tax, looked at $300 million credit reduction in Cook Inlet and $100 million credit reduction in the North Slope as budget cuts that we could make. And what does that do? Well, as you can see, the earnings reserve still stays healthy. The CBR, I mean, the total fund still stays healthy. The CBR actually goes up and would actually go out to 2034. And so we've got a long-term slide, long-term to make other adjustments in. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that with one vote, all these things combined together gives fair and balance to the citizens of the state. It's nothing that if anybody was making any one of these decisions, you wouldn't want to make them. But if you have to have a package that comes together, solves the problem, and you can do it at one time in a fair and balanced way, that was the purpose of putting the plan together. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions. You have another packet of backup slides that I've given you if anyone wants to go into the details of the income tax, and that's available as well. And, Mr. Chairman, there's also Brandon Spanos, Jerry from DOR, and we have Sarah from PFD and John Hutchins. From the Department of Law, if you would like to get information from any of those as well.
Okay, questions from committee. It's a lot to swallow, I'm sure. Representative Guttenberg, followed by Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you twice in one day. So part of this calculation is turning into the permanent fund into a POMV.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there is a POMV element at 2.3% POMV, so it's nothing that is, you know, bumping up anything that would damage the fund.
Anything damage to the what?
The fund. It won't diminish the fund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. My question is, you know, we've dealt with other POMVs in the past, and sometimes I know your payout is 2.5%, which is more moderate than the other proposals we've seen. But without a what happens if it goes below, if the earnings are really low, if we hit a real bad time? And to get that 2.5%, we have to hit a it goes into the principal, or we're locked out of the principal. What happens at that point? How do you perceive that as being affected, and what's the ramifications?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think that, you know, that's why this is a very low rate. We think that the earnings over time, it's a five-year average, will not approach that. There's nothing that we can do in statute that could invade the principle. That calculation will always be made by the Permanent Fund Corporation, because legally we can't go into the principle. And that would, you know, take a long time, and we would be in a worse shape for a lot of other reasons. But, you know, I think that this plan gets us new revenue that offsets instead of just trying to make everything up out of the earnings of the permanent fund somehow. This actually brings in new revenue, and we're counting on the legislature to make budget cuts as well. I mean, we extend the CBR out through 2024, even if we don't make any budget cuts, even if we have the exact budget that we passed out of the House. But I'm sure the legislature is not going to do that because we know we need to address the problem in all three of those ways, the sensible spending cuts, the PFD, and new revenues.
Mr. Chair, just one more question.
Representative Guttenberg.
So the plan has a cap but no floor. The PFD part of this calculation has a top cap but no floor.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that's right. And the reason it doesn't have a floor is if it had a floor, if you had a series of a number of years of really bad returns and you weren't generating the money, then what you would be doing is saying, oh, we're going to be taking additional money above the formula to make payouts. And that is when you really start getting into problems instead of using the formula to generate the money based on the earnings. Remember that the permanent fund is basically oil, green oil. It's oil that's been turned into cash, been turned into money. And so we're using that investment as the source of the money, not the pool, but the investment stream. And if that investment stream is not keeping up, then there would be real problems that we would have to address again.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Edwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, can you talk a little bit about how this plan differentiates from the existing plans that are out there? Senator McGuire, Representative Hawker, the governor's plan, relative to how your plan would treat or perhaps separate out the impact on those that earn more money versus those that are, you know, in the lower income categories?
There's kind of through the chair, Representative, and there's a couple of questions there together. So let me talk about the first one, and that is the other plans tend to say we're going to directly use very volatile royalties, which are valued based on price, to pay or be a contributor to the dividend itself. And the problem with that is when prices are low, that means you're going to have a low dividend. And what you really want to do is have things out of cycle so that a dividend is paid out based on investment earnings over time so that when prices are low, you still aid the economy by having a healthy dividend. If you cycle those together, then when prices are low, the dividend goes low and you accelerate the problems in your economy. So that's one of the differentials there. I think you were talking about the PFDs. If you're talking about the permanent fund itself, the difference is that the other plans totally restructure the way the funds are made up, and it's much more complicated. This leaves everybody doing the job that they've been doing. Permanent Fund Corporation managing the permanent fund, the permanent fund division making the applications, taking those, distributing the permanent fund dividend. The only difference is they're distributing 25% instead of 50% of the distributable earnings. But everybody's job is the same. And the tax division does what the tax division does. So we're not trying to mix and match and have people basically do somebody else's job. Not that they can't do it, but this is attempting to keep everything clean and easy, and everyone in the state of Alaska knows how the permanent fund works, and they know how the permanent fund dividend works, and this keeps all of those the same. But the balance, I don't have the graph on the how they influence each segment of the economy, but I can tell you that the we've seen the graphs of if you have a permanent fund dividend reduction, it hits families that have low income or more kids harder, much higher percentage of their income, and that's why we balance that with an income tax, which hits the wealthier harder, if that answers your question.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, and that was sort of the crux of the question. I don't think I asked it very in a very good way, but I guess maybe to hone in a little bit and give you more of an opportunity, and I know we're looking at things tonight at a high level, but the refundable tax provision, the box that's second to the left on the very bottom, really lends itself to being, like you were saying a moment ago, less regressive for those that make less money and who depend more on their annual permanent fund dividend. And I think it's fair to say that that's a distinguishing feature between your plan and all of the other plans that are out there at this point. But then again, I know tonight's high level. We're not getting into the details. I just wanted to hear more, and perhaps in another presentation we'll actually get into the nitty-gritty. But the point was to get some commentary on that regressivity feature of this plan, which I think is a highly attractive part of the overall plan.
Further questions from committee at this time? Wow. Not seeing any more questions tonight. Representative Seaton, thank you and your staff for being here to present the bill tonight. I'm going to set this bill aside at this time. And our next Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Friday, April 8th. And I know we've spent more time here than we have in our own apartments and homes lately, so we're going to have a big day tomorrow. So tomorrow we're going to meet at 10 a.m. At that time, we're going back to House Bill 247, Tax Credits, Interest Refunds, Oil and Gas, and take amendments. With that, at 7:20 p.m., we are adjourned.